Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where this week I am joined by Matt Hirsch and Steve Crow, co-founders of Blue Green Clinical. Gents, welcome to the show. I know that you've given me the heads up that you could talk for hours, so we'll try and keep it inside that. But look, Matt, Steve, give us a quick overview as to, I guess, Blue Green Clinical, first of all. You know, what's the new business about? I believe it's started fairly recently, but if you can give us a quick heads up on that, that'd be useful.
Steve, do you want to?
I'll start, and we've got quite a good tag team here sometimes, James. I start, and then Matt fills in all the gaps and blanks that I forget about.
Lovely.
Effectively, Blue Green Clinical is the two of us, and effectively, we see ourselves as a small consultancy, two people, who can help biotech, pharma startups, small pharma, or sometimes up to medium-sized pharma, with advice and potentially day-to-day operations on how to run clinical trials. Sure. So our kind of history that allows us to, you know, feel that we could offer a great service at the consultancy is that both Matt and I worked at GW Pharmaceuticals, which was a biotech startup that both of us joined in 2004. And we've stayed there for nigh on 20 years each. We kind of left the resultant company, GW, had a partnership with and acquired by Jazz at the end of last year. So served 18 and 19 years respectively as a single company working in clinical operations. And we've seen the whole journey all the way through. And so we feel it's a bit of a unique experience. There's plenty of folk in the industry with many decades of experience and probably, you know, more decades than us. But staying at a single company and a company that started off at the size of 50, 60 people when we joined,
wow,
and finished off after the acquisition at nearly 3,000 has allowed us to see quite a unique kind of growth period for a biotech startup. So we are clinical operations. We're the guys that, you know, are the nuts and bolts, the main cog in the clinical development wheel when you want to run clinical trials. Yeah. And so we feel we can offer salient advice, help people to understand the mistakes that we made so they don't repeat them. I think that's a key thing in our industry. Running clinical trials with humans is quite a difficult thing to constrain. And so a lot of the time, we're often dealing with reacting to issues that you couldn't anticipate. And so we've got great experience in that regard. Also, as you might know, it's a heavily regulated industry. So I think after air traffic control, there's more regulation around running clinical trials, i.e. giving investigational products to human beings, than virtually any other industry out there. So it's really important to make sure that when you are a sponsor, that company that is responsible, is funding and running the clinical trial, even if you're outsourcing your activities to a CRO, which is quite common with small pharma, your activities may be delegated, but your responsibilities remain. And therefore, you need to have processes in place to make sure that you're compliant and that you're fulfilling your obligations. And so we can help with that as well. We're basically, I think, given our experience, what I'm trying to say is we've got no problems rolling our sleeves up and getting in the weeds, dealing with the details, with the process. But also we've got that long experience that allows us to have that kind of helicopter view that can see things from a distance. And particularly, I think, give companies advice on other things to set up in the present day that will help them as they go through their growth journey and help them to hopefully avoid some of the pitfalls that we came across as we were trailblazing in our part of the industry, which I guess I should mention was the fact that GW Pharmaceuticals were the first company globally anywhere to try and to be successful in making a proper medicine, a regulatory approved medicine from ingredients of the cannabis plant. So Matt and I were both heavily involved in the regulatory approval of Sativex, a compound used to treat pain and multiple sclerosis, different presentations of that. Epidiolex, which is approved in the United States, a blockbuster drug used to treat pediatric refractory epilepsy. So I'll pause, take breath. Matt, any?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly it. So it is actually quite interesting, James, that over the last few months, so while we were thinking about kind of doing this, we spoke to companies and startups, and it was fascinating to that there's definitely a need for what we offer, because what we found is they're brilliant scientists and they have all the investment kind of looking at what they're going to be doing, which is so important. But when it comes to the trial, there was a real mindset of, well, we'll raise the money and we'll give it to the CRO and we'll keep it at arm's length and now just give us the data. And that's actually to Steve's point, you know, that actually the regulations, et cetera, are so specific that you need to, you know, you need to take an active involvement in your clinical research, even if you're a small startup giving, giving these studies to CROs. So it was a real kind of, we thought, there's a market, a niche here, a market here for advice that is clinical operation focused. Not, we're not clinical scientists as such. We have awareness of it and we know how things work. But we are about how you actually start your trials, how you get things up and running, how you oversee the vendors. And we have a good knowledge across the board of clinical trials, so from pharmacovigilance to regulatory, et cetera. And we have a lot of contacts as well that we can also offer clients to bring it, bring in that specific knowledge as needed. But we just found there was a gap. When we're talking to companies, there's a gap in understanding clinical operations. A lot of them thought it was just clinical development, where you know you just decide on some certain scientific aspects of it. But it's quite niche, but really important, I think, that we can hopefully help companies.
Definitely. So, it sounds like you've both got impressive backgrounds there. And I guess, you know, just that, that piece where you say, look, you realise that there's a lot of biotechs and startups that could perhaps benefit from this. I guess having been there from the beginning, like 50-odd staff through to, you know, thousands when the acquisition was made, you've been through that whole cycle, haven't you? So seeing the challenges at each stage, is that one of the things that you perhaps help companies with, is that that early stage, but then kind of scaling?
Yeah, you know, exactly. And I think that's important, James, actually. We understand what it's like to have your own, you know, your own baby, your own, this is your molecule, this is what you want to take. And you invest a hell of a lot of time and effort and money into this, to this molecule that you want to, you know, grow up, essentially. So we've done that. We've been there. And we actually ran the trials in the early days ourselves. So we're used to doing the trials ourselves. And we did that before we started outsourcing. So then we moved to outsourcing models as we became more global. And that gave us that experience of how to work with vendors. So now when we advise clients, it's a case of, you know, we've kind of, it's a plumber overseeing a plumber, to kind of say. And that just gives a slight edge and a slight difference to people that have never run a trial directly themselves. They've never had to write a protocol or go and sit in front of ethics or whatever it may be. This definitely does help. So yeah, that's our journey really, is starting trials ourselves all the way through to managing and overseeing CROs at global level, program level, and then also managing clinical operations teams. So myself and Steve grew through the company to actually oversee kind of people, process and tools. So that's why we got more and more involved in the actual how to do things, you know, the processes and the regulations around stuff. So it's a very varied experience we have, isn't it, Steve?
It is, it is. And as we said, we've been on a single journey that has allowed us to see various stages of growth and to appreciate scalability. But I think the thing as well, James, is when you look at a company that, you know, starts off, you know, they need to manufacture their potential medicinal product. That's a whole area of expertise. You know, you need to do your animal work. That's a whole area of preclinical expertise. And then you move, Matt said, into that point, that exciting point where you're ready to start thinking about administering your potential product to humans. I would call that area clinical development. And Matt and I are very clear that we are clinical operations within clinical development. And I think, as Matt's alluded to already, what that speaks to is it, you know, at all these stages at IMP manufacture, at preclinical and at clinical stage, clinical development stage, you don't get one person that can come in and can help you with everything. There's too many specialties to be able to know everything and be the master of everything. But what clinical operations always is within an industry, and what our experience at GW was, is that we were the central cog, we were the engine house that drove most effectively the rest of clinical development. So allowed us to work with, you know, regulatory strategy colleagues, you know, our chief medical officer, for example, our regulatory affairs colleagues to speak to the competent authorities, pharmacovigilance, data management, statistics, clinical trial supplies, all these various specialties all need to come together to be able to drive forward a proper clinical development project. And that central hub was us. So we can transfer that sort of behavior now to consulting with our potential clients. As Matt said, we can be very good at giving you your base level processes, your SOPs, so that you can select a vendor, so that you can contract with them in the way that the MHRA states clearly that you need to. Then in addition, we can say, well, actually, we also think you need some regulatory strategy advice here about your whole kind of process that you might want to put together for an IND application. And we have a colleague that can help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, if things progress and you're into a phase two trial, and there's a bit more complex statistics in that than there is in a standard healthy volunteer phase one, it might be that the sponsor client, you know, outsources all the day-to-day activities for statistics to a CRO to do.
Mm.
But it could be very sensible as a sponsor, you know, with that baby, as Matt said, to just double check on all those specialties, key specialties as well. And again, Matt and I at that point would say, well, we are not statisticians, but we know people that can help to come in fractionally and oversee that for a period of time. So I feel that anyone that maybe suggests that they can talk confidently over every aspect of clinical development is either a genius and quite rare, or I think potentially clinical operations folk have got the best chance of seeing how everything comes together, can do certain things, and then have the contacts to bring in other expertise when needed.
Yeah, and half the problem, Steve, is what we've seen is the language. You know, it's actually talk. So CROs will come to a startup and they'll present, and they'll talk a language that actually sometimes a startup doesn't know. You know,
have you got any examples of that, Matt? I guess just to give it the kind of an overview.
It could just be anything about certain plans or certain regulations. You start talking about, you know, EAR1, all this stuff that is just, okay, what is that? Or even to the point of good clinical practice. That sounds quite strange. But if someone says GCP, there are companies that are thinking about going to the clinic that aren't aware of the regulations in GCP.
Wow.
So that sounds really quite basic, but it's to that point, you know.
Is that quite common then, I guess, with startups? Because I guess I'm picturing, you know, maybe small startups where, you know, kind of the founder may be the scientist, as it may be. They don't necessarily know the operations world. They don't know the commercial world, perhaps like you guys do. Is that quite common that you find that they're not understanding some of the language, and that's where you guys perhaps step in? Or
I hope it's not common. You know, I think hopefully if you're going to start doing trials, there's a little bit of, you know, research that's done beforehand to make sure you are compliant with the rules. But, you know, a lot of the time it's you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know the questions to ask. Actually, that's half the battle as well. So, and there are some vendors that will maybe take advantage of that. And that's why hopefully we can help the clients be their de facto ClinOps reps, you know, and actually talk the same language. But there are things that will crop up. I mean, there's a lot of words that are used in regulation that, you know, actually, what does it mean? Steve, you know, like, you know, serious breach in the UK, you know, so CRO could talk about that serious breach process and everything else, but actually, what does it mean to certain people? Where we know it quite well, so we can challenge that and say, well, hold on, that doesn't make sense. Or you say you do this, but actually you're doing that, you know, so it's that kind of stuff, Steve.
Yeah, I think that's actually the key point, James. I think because we've said before, you know, we work in such a heavily regulated industry, whether that's the regulations that, you know, are in the UK or United States, Australasia, anywhere that has, you know, as a developed nation now running clinical trials, effectively has good clinical practice reference within their legislation. Matt and I, as say a sponsor, representative of the sponsor, are so used to some of this language that is in GCP and in regulation, that when we speak to a CRO, we're talking English to each other. My foreign languages aren't particularly great, but we understand each other. And I think it's unfair. I think, as Matt said, you know, a general appreciation within the, you know, our clients, I think is there. You know, they are making the effort to understand about GCP, and that's great. But when you're not living it day to day, you can't have that seamless conversation with a clinical research organization, where you're not effectively kind of stopping and asking and questioning. And so I just think you need to have people that are experts in this part of the industry to represent the biotech startup sponsor when they're speaking to the CRO. Because
definitely.
And what you find with regulated industries is the way to spot them is they have more three-letter abbreviations than you can shake a stick at. So in our industry...
That's true.
You know, when I grew up, SAE was stamped addressed envelope. In our industry, it's serious adverse event. And that's a critical thing to understand. And that relates to SARS and SARS. And the more abbreviations there are, the more indication that you're part of the industry you're working in is pretty complicated. And just to save a bit of time, you abbreviate things. But, you know, Matt and I can have a conversation freely about this topic together, and someone from outside of our specialty could sit there and they would struggle to understand what we're talking about.
I think if you guys got into a full conversation, I'd be looking behind my computer here where I've got a list of hundreds of acronyms to try and keep me on track when I'm sometimes interviewing people and they're throwing them out. I'm like, could you just let me know what that is? But like, I think that's your very point, isn't it? That there's so much that people sometimes just don't know that they don't know.
That, and people like myself and Matt have assumed knowledge where we assume, because we've been so familiar with it, that when we're talking, people understand. And literally, we've just gone through an exercise this week producing some documentation for a client, where we've gone in and we've dug down into quite a detailed document to help explain certain topics that Matt and I take for granted. And it was fascinating, having done kind of one round of it, when we re-reviewed it, how many things were still picked up that actually, yes, you're right, we know what that is, but we can't assume that our client does. And it's a very detailed part of the industry, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah,
indeed. And so look, you guys started Blue Green back in, did you say March or May?
May.
When, I mean, I'm just interested, I guess, what led you to, I guess, go into partnership with each other? Naturally, you'd worked together before, clearly good enough colleagues that you felt you could work together. Where did the business idea come from? Was it a joint thing, or did one of you call the other one and say, hey, I've got this idea, would you fancy this? How did it come about?
We have been speaking for a while about it, haven't we, Steve? And we've worked together for nearly 20 years. You know, I mean, Steve lives in Manchester, I live in Cambridge, so that's about as close as we'll, you know, get to each other. Steve had to move, unfortunately, because Steve was in Cambridge as a student and then moved away. But no, you know, it was those discussions we had with other companies that you start realizing that they could do with some help, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe we should give it a try. We had an opportunity, we had some, you know, to do this, which is great. And we thought, yeah, let's give it a try and see if we can use our knowledge and our experience and our mistakes that have been made over the years and just help companies just put them on the right path. You know, we're not about sledgehammers and cracking nuts and all this kind of stuff. It's about just starting that journey, which is, as Steve's, you know, mentioned, is highly regulated, and just starting them on the right track and being that first port of call almost, you know, getting us involved early so we can have discussions, and then just saying, just realize this is good clinical practice. These are the kind of things you maybe need to have in place at the start. This is how you can look at for vendors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But just having that knowledge, just so there's no surprises when they get to these big milestones in their company's journey, really.
Sure. And how about for yourselves? I mean, how has the business formed?
Matt, you know, quite rightly said that we've worked together for two decades, so clearly we know we can work together. You know, we have our ups and downs, but I think for me, there are a couple of things. There's a kind of human level element here that I think. And a lot of our colleagues put these comments when we announced we founded the company. Matt and I work well together. We complement each other. So there's good overlap when we need to have things looked at with a second pair of eyes.
Yeah. But
in addition, the sum of our parts is more than us individually in terms of what we bring to the team with our kind of expertise. But that also then goes to help with the fact that ClinOps is, as I said already, a complicated area, but it's also often some of the most expensive parts of a biotech's kind of spend. So you can start easily spending, you know, $5 million on a reasonable sized phase two. Some of the phase ones can be quite expensive, let alone the cost of a phase three, if ever a startup wanted to start venturing into there. So it's, you know, you want to make sure as best you can, without going over the top, that you're not doing anything wrong. And so having more than one set of eyes, rather than Matt and I individually acting as consultants, which a lot of people do very effectively, we feel that just the two of us, just more than just one, two people looking at things, some person maybe leading with one client and the other colleague coming in to have another look afterwards, is just a really excellent way to make sure, again, that you've got robustness in what you're doing when you're running a clinical trial.
Kind of that mastermind effect, isn't it? That, yeah, one and one no longer equals two, it actually equals more than that. And that's, I think, what you're getting at there, Steve, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, yeah, we're more than the sum of our parts.
Two heads is better than one, definitely. But no, going back to your original thing, James, you know, how did we start? It was literally, we had a bit of time off at the start of the year after leaving GW Jazz.
Mm.
And we were networking. We were speaking to companies and stuff that seemed to have a need for our kind of advice and help.
Mm.
And then we thought, you know what? Let's give it a try. Literally, it was, let's give it a try. You know,
wow.
It's, you know, it's nice to be able to use our experiences to try and help further, you know, other companies, but also other medications and other patients down the line. That's the reality of it.
Mm. It kind of speaks to it, doesn't it? That kind of Simon Sinek, you know, start with why, find mm-hmm. your why. And again, you know, what kept Matt and I at GW, certainly I can speak for myself, and I'm guessing Matt feels the same way, you know, every day, James, wasn't a bed of roses. There are ups and downs, and we stuck through the downs and enjoyed the ups.
Mm.
But the reason we did that was, I think, for me, twofold. We work with wonderful, lovely people that you see as friends as well as colleagues, not just Matt, but a whole group of folk, a lot of whom are still at GW, again, 10, 15, 20 years plus kind of loyalty to the company, but now Jazz.
Mm.
But in addition, we were doing something that we could really believe in. You know, we were bringing to the world a wedge of the pharmaceutical pie, the cannabinoids field, that really had been somewhat untouched until then. And so we were blazing a trail, bringing medicines that, you know, addressed unmet medical need. And I think particularly in the early days when you were a small team, that was really invigorating and, you know, got you jumping out of bed in the morning. And I think what we're finding, speaking to, you know, the clients that we've got already and other potential clients, they're also at that early stage of the journey where you can feel that excitement, that electricity. And I think you want to get out of your bed every day and not only do a good job, but do a good job that you know you're going to enjoy with people you enjoy working with. So this gives us the chance to kind of recreate that buzz with multiple clients potentially. And you know, why wouldn't you?
I like it.
And then true to our kind of thing about solid foundations, that's ultimately what we're going to put in play. You want to make sure we're starting companies on the right path. We did that with ourselves. So we sat down literally May the 1st and we said, right, let's just, rather than just go out there straight away, let's put in our foundation. So we've got the company name properly, we've got bank accounts set up, we've got, you know, websites, etc., email addresses, all the stuff that you need to start properly. Mm. And then we kind of went to the wider world and start saying, hello, if we can help, that'd be great. Because there's a lot of consultants that just go out on their own, as Steve said, and they're just straight to their own. And sometimes, you know, they're not set up or they get busy quite quickly and then they have to backtrack a bit to find a bank account to get such and such. Mm. So we want everything in place to have solid foundations. And that's what we did. Definitely. And the name came about because we were looking at, me and Steve like going out for hikes and walks into the countryside. And we've always said, it sounds a bit cheesy, but we've always said a bit of blue and green is good for the soul. Right? A bit of blue skies and green fields is always good for the soul. And that's kind of the essence of why we called it that, blue-green clinical. So it's not...
I think I read that on your website, actually. I was having a quick look before we jumped on. I think it looks like you're both into hiking, walking, the outdoors, etc. So kind of bringing that element to what you do at work as well.
Exactly. That was what it was about, really. So...
And for a second layer of cheese, it also leads to a term that we talk about on our website, and we have in one of our kind of logo strap lines, which is eco. And when you think of the term eco, you think of ecological, you think again of blue, green, Mother Earth and the sea and things. But for us, eco is excellence in clinical operations.
Another little free letter acronym.
Yeah, well, it's not a common one in the industry. That's one ourselves.
That's not a regulated one yet, James. We'll get it there.
I'll add it to my list.
Okay.
But it speaks to our logo. You know, we've got, you know, caring hands that are helping to nurture something to grow.
Yeah.
And you do that, we believe, in whatever your specialty is by having excellence and particularly differentiating that from perfection. Because perfection is very rarely attainable, if ever, and the pursuit of perfection can mean that you spend your finite resources on things that aren't important.
Mm.
Whereas excellence talks about, again, some of the things that Matt's mentioned already, this idea of not taking a sledgehammer to crack a nut, believing that quality is the absence of errors that matter, not the absence of all errors. It's about creating things that are fit for purpose, that have the ability to scale appropriately as well, so that you're not having to constantly reinvent yourself. So it all ties up, this kind of blue-green motif ties up with this idea of us helping to nurture things and having that approach of wanting to achieve excellence rather than unachievable perfection.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Better than the name Huxley Morton then. I mean, I just slapped that together with the missus. I mean, it's a bit of a story, but I won't bore you with you guys with that just yet. I'll save it maybe for afterwards. See, look, if we were to give people a snapshot of how things are going then, you're both collaborating. I guess it must be a completely different lifestyle, though, from working with kind of what I would now class as a big organization in GW Jazz as what it is modern day, to kind of you two on your own and helping smaller companies. How has your day-to-day life changed?
Oh, that's it. Good one. Do you want to go first, Steve?
I can say and give chance to Matt to think. If I can be completely honest, James, the biggest single thing, because I've always worked from home when I was with GW Jazz, Matt.
Yeah.
In the office, so Matt might have a different take in terms of that regard, but you know, working for home for me has always been here, it's not changed. The biggest single difference I've noticed is that my email inbox now is full of emails that matter, emails that are important that I need to respond to, whereas through no fault of any company, what I always found, and you know what you kind of read about if you read kind of scaling up, so in Pursuit of Excellence by Professor Peters from the 1980s, it's often this idea that as a company grows, you have economies of scale, and that's true in certain things, but actually generally if a company grows tenfold from 10 people to 100, the complexity within that company is 10 to the power 10, it's 100-fold. So what I found over the years is, irrespective of my level of seniority at GW then Jazz, my email inbox just got bigger and bigger and bigger every day. And, you know, you need to manage that appropriately and not spend too much time on it. But sometimes it's hard to see the wood for the trees. But with it being just Matt and I at the moment, and with our number of clients, it's the complexity has completely resolved. And so it's so much easier to start your day knowing what you need to do, there's very little that's irrelevant, I think. I'm finding that quite refreshing.
I was going to say, it seems as though like I can almost feel the weight falling off your shoulders there, Steve.
I think we all have it. We've all had it, haven't we, in our careers. And it can be, you know, it's just one of those things. But this is certainly a perk.
Yeah. I mean, I miss the days when I used to send Steve 150 random emails. That kept him on his toes. But no, I think it's that flexibility, James. You know, that's they always say. And I went on some courses with LinkedIn Learning and things like this around, you know, going out on your own and stuff. And that was kind of a message which it is very different. If you're used to being in the office to suddenly now you're at home and you know your journey hasn't been mapped out for you, you've got to go and do that yourself. It can be daunting for a lot of people. I was in the office, but COVID had definitely changed the world, and that's where I've now sat at home for the last three and a half years.
Yeah.
Went in now and again, but definitely the transition has been easier because I've kind of almost down titrated my you know involvement with people in the office as such. But I like the flexibility, but I like the fact, to Steve's point, the complexity is a lot easier. Me and Steve will work on something together, and it's, you know, it's only us two and we'll come to an agreement, and we have debates. We're very different people, but we come up with a really good product, we think, and a good way forward. But for me, I like the flexibility, but I also like the fact that, you know, we are trying to help these companies and we are responsible for our own kind of journey on this. You know, we can make decisions quickly, instantly, things like that.
It comes back to, again, what we said before about kind of, you know, two heads are better than one, and that cheesy term kind of teamwork makes the dream work. You know, Matt calls it debate. I think it's Patrick Lencioni's got, you know, quite a popular book, The Five Habits of the Team or something. I forget what it's called exactly. But one of those kind of bad habits, five dysfunctions of the team, that's it. And one of the base layers there is if you have a lack of trust in the team, and Matt and I together are a small team, but we're a team, then you have a fear of conflict. And some people feel that conflict is an issue. But whenever conflict is about a topic or a piece of information rather than between individuals about character, then that's where you get that healthy debate. And that's, again, where you get this idea of two heads are better than one. You've got proper teamwork. And Matt and I know each other inside out. We've worked with each other for 20 years, and we've got no qualms in either of us saying, not sure about this, or I don't agree with that. And then we talk it out. And that fear of conflict, because we trust each other, again, I think is a critical thing in this industry. When things are complicated, you need a team. I think relying on individuals is a struggle.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, yeah, you need people that are like-minded and understand each other. I guess I run the business with my wife. I guess sometimes I am scared of the conflict if she disagrees, but she's the boss, she's the mastermind. So normally I just say, yeah, that's fantastic, let's do it. What about the entrepreneurial side? Because, you know, GW Jazz, I'm guessing nowadays, is probably quite corporate. You know, now that you have that flexibility to, you know, get on with things, faster decisions, immediate decisions, how, I'm guessing that that's probably one thing that you're enjoying. I guess, what have been the bigger challenges that you faced on the entrepreneurial side? Because now it's down to you two. You have to, you know, anyone always thinks, oh, I'm an entrepreneur, it's very sexy, it's a great term to throw on your LinkedIn or whatever, but it is quite challenging as well, isn't it? Because you're constantly having to win business. Yeah. How have you adapted to that side of things?
I think the first thing is we actually enjoy talking to companies. That is actually what we really do enjoy, Steve, you know. And we've been very lucky. We had a couple of clients early on, which was great. And we've literally, I mean, the last 4 to 6 weeks, Steve, we've spoken to more and more people, and our name is getting out there. So I think the hard part, the challenge, is to get out there, to start thinking about avenues of, you know, ways to get out there. So we're looking at joining networks. I've joined like the Cambridge Network, which is a good way of meeting different people. There's different LinkedIn forums. There's obviously using LinkedIn as a good way of meeting people. And then just networking. So, you know, network makes the dream work as well. That's the reality of it.
And what we've done
actually is we've reached out to people that also could help us as a consultancy wide. So we become like, we're trying to create a network of consultants as well. So if we don't know an answer to, like we alluded to earlier, then maybe we know people that can help. And actually you realize people are quite happy to talk. If you reach out to them and say, hey, this is what we do, we'd like to learn more about what you do, can we meet up for half an hour? And then from that, they've said, oh, can you meet this person or meet this person? And actually we've had clients refer people as well, which is nice. But
Very nice.
Also just keeping that network of people engaged with what we're doing, and also just not being scared to reach out. As I said, people sometimes hesitate or whatever, and actually it's nice to talk, and that we actually enjoy talking to a lot of the companies we're working with, and hopefully working with soon.
I think as you say, it is good to talk, and when you start seeing it, I've always seen it as like when I'm doing business development or sales, if you want to look at it that way, that I'm actually reaching out to see if companies have got a problem that I fix, and in which case I'm helping. I'm not necessarily selling, in which if they tell me that everything's absolutely incredible with their recruitment, you know, they're married to their recruiting team or whatever, I'm like, fine, like, no worries, stay as you are. It's the individuals that need the help that actually become your best clients, because they value what you do. And that way you're not selling, are you? It's you're just helping and, you know, advising, consulting.
That's exactly it, James. And it's like another Simon Sinek point about what's your motivator? What's your why again? And I think Matt and I are just both genuinely curious about the industry. We're genuinely curious about what happened at GW and Jazz as various things evolved. And, you know, we've retained that curiosity with our current clients. And so what we enjoy is finding out what we can do to help, just to your very point there. And then I think as a result of that, if you then develop a relationship that becomes something that's professional, then income is effectively more of a fuel for the business to allow you to do what you enjoy doing every day when you get up. You know, we all have to eat and pay the bills. But when you see that as a consequence of you doing what your passion is, then I think that makes that scary leap into being an entrepreneur in this part of the business, being a consultant, that little bit more kind of digestible. Yes, there are risks, but we're willing to take them because Matt and I just want to go out there and be intellectually stimulated and curious and seeing what's happening in the industry and seeing where we can help. You know, don't reinvent the wheel. Don't make the mistakes we made over the past two decades. And we've made enough of them. You know, listen to our experience, hopefully, and we can try and guide a smoother path. And I think everything just falls into place. So I think it's about what your interests and your priorities are.
And yeah. I think now to that point, Steve, our experience of, you know, it's solid. You know, we have a depth of experience, which also gives you more of a confidence to say, you know, if you want to help, we're more than happy to help. You know, I think if we didn't have the experiences we've gone through, it's always a bit harder sometimes to reach out to people. I don't know why, but I think we know what we know.
Comfortable in it, aren't you? You know, it's your expertise. You've been there and done it. And when you're just sharing your knowledge,
yeah,
you're not putting on a front. You're unlikely to suffer from any sort of imposter syndrome or anything because you could probably do it in your sleep. That being said, I guess it probably, you are coming from a different angle now. Is there anything that you have adapted or maybe learned about yourself since, I guess, making the switch?
That's a good question, Craig.
We learn about ourselves. And you know what, actually, for me, it's great that we've got some early clients, which is really nice. There's definite momentum building. We've had lots of nice conversations. And sometimes you have to take a step back and go, actually, we should be pretty proud of how we've started. We've only been going 3 months or so.
Yeah.
And we've had a good start and there is a need for what we offer. And if we can help, that's great, you know. But I think, yeah, sometimes people forget to take a step back and look at what you've achieved. When things are, you know, a little bit quieter now and again, use that as a chance to network again and whatever you need to do. But always take a step back and think, yeah, we should be proud of what we've achieved. But I don't know, has it changed me? I'm not sure, Steve. What do you think?
I'm not sure it necessarily changed me, and I'm going to say this comment, and if any of our ex-colleagues listen to it, they'll probably say that I'm telling a porky. But one of the luxuries that we had at the start, as Matt said, with us, you know, kind of, you know, first things first, begin with the end in mind, putting our solid foundations, we've had this blank piece of paper, and we've been able to, you know, I was able to sit down and read, you know, a very detailed industry guidance for a number of days and try to transfer that into knowledge that we could basically, we've mapped out all the 100 plus responsibilities and activities that a sponsor has when they do a clinical trial. And how can you reconfigure all that to have in place as fewer SOPs that you need to satisfy legislation if you're outsourcing your trial to a CRO? And we've come up with the magic number 13, tristecophobia, on the number of SOPs that you need eventually before a trial starts. And just to go and find a vendor, you need 3 key SOPs and then 5 to set up a quality management system. We've had to write some of those SOPs and documents. And I'm maybe known in the past as being a bit pedantic and detail orientated, but I found out that there's only so long I can stare at a document without having to need to kind of go and get a bit of fresh air, get some headspace and clear my head. So that has been nice. You can break that up with, you know, us catching up with ex-colleagues and potential contacts and stuff. So I'm not necessarily as fully embraced in detail maybe as I used to be, but I wonder whether that's just part of my kind of career journey rather than the move from GW Jazz into consultancy. But
I think also, Steve, I think it's what you're talking about there is fit for purpose. You've become enlightened to the fit for purpose kind of mindset, you know, and you're right. You know, as we became more complex, as GW evolved and grew and started doing, you know, global programs. Yeah, there's more chefs in the kitchen and there's more, you know, focus on things. So Steve was talking about the complexities of things go up, but definitely at the moment with some of the companies we're working with that are really startups, you don't need that level of complexity. So you can produce things that are fit for purpose and that will then evolve with the company. You know, I don't want people thinking that, you know, GCP is like, you know, a rigid iron cage. It's not. It's about understanding, interpreting the rules. And if GCP told you exactly what to do, every company will do it the same way. It doesn't, because this is what we want to see. And it's up to you on the how. And that's where we can bring our knowledge to these companies, say, this is what it says, this is actually how it happens. We've gone through numerous MHRA inspections. I think we've done 4 MHRA inspections and 1 FDA inspection, which is a great experience, actually. You know, we work in a regulated industry. We're privileged enough to be able to do what we do using, you know, developing new medications. And that comes with regulation, understandably. Mm. And with regulation comes inspection. And I think inspections are a positive thing. So we've been lucky enough to go through these inspections. Yes, there's a lot of preparation work for things, but it is so important that people understand the regulations and what you're trying to do. You're putting, you know, trial medication into humans.
Yeah.
And things can go wrong, and that's why it's important that things are done properly.
I've got a question, I guess, just taking you back a moment to where you said, kind of looking back on the last 3 months of, you know, considering maybe how you've changed, how life has changed, etc. Clearly, you've been picking up clients, and things, from my viewpoint, seem to be going well. Have you thought about what's been the biggest success for yourselves just yet? You know, if you were to kind of look back and think, oh my God, you know, actually, when we started this and sat down and said, let's go out and do this. Now, looking back, what would you kind of label as kind of that biggest success or achievement, whether it's been a client or particular result or story that you've heard from someone that you've worked with?
My view on that one, James, is, you know, the business that we've had so far has come, I think, as a result of genuine trusted relationships that we've had in the past at whatever stage.
Mm.
And they've been maintained, and people have come back to us as a result of that. And I think alongside that, they've seen us as a pair of people that have integrity. And I think with that, then you get the trust. So I think it's the fact that, again, part of the reason Matt and I stayed at GW Jazz for so long through the ups and downs was because we worked with people that we really enjoyed working with, and we've been lucky enough to stay in contact with them. I think what kind of goes around comes around. So we've been able to either pull on them directly, or folk have seen what we're doing and come to us to offer their help. And I think that's because, again, there's a mutual kind of, you know, respect there with various people we've been lucky to work with over the years.
Nice.
Yeah, I agree completely. That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say a network. It's a network. It's the reality that we developed, you know, good friendships with people over the years.
Mm.
I mean, we were talking to someone last week that left GW, what, 14 years ago, 15 years ago, that we're still in touch with.
Wow. You know?
And I think that kind of stuff's important.
I think you do just build up that bank, don't you? But that bank of trust. And I guess, yeah, experience, you have to earn it. You can't learn it.
Yeah.
No, go on.
I was just saying, our first client came through an ex-colleague that we've stayed in touch with that said, hold on, you know, speak to these people. And that was great. So they always, you know, the word of mouth is, you can't, you know, it's so important. It's so important. And
sure.
That's where we've kind of maintained those relationships over the years. Steve?
Awesome.
Yeah, again, it just speaks to this idea of active giving. I don't know if you've heard of an author called Adam Grant, who's done quite a few books and podcasts. He's in the same
name. I can't say I've read anything or heard anything, but yeah, know the name.
Yeah, him and Brené Brown are all best friends with Simon Sinek. The three of them constantly feature in each other's podcasts and author many books. And he has a book called Give and Take. So he talks about this idea of the people that tend to, you know, do well are the active givers, not the takers. So, and again, I don't think, you know, Matt and I have done this before we even knew this book existed, but it speaks to that principle of, again, just be curious, want to maintain relationships and friendships, and, you know, I think things then come back over time, and, you know, we're very grateful for that.
Definitely agree with that one. And look, guys, I guess we're coming towards the end of the show here, but what's next on the cards for yourself? I mean, you're only 3 months in. What are the plans? What's the runway looking like for yourselves?
At the moment, so we'd like to be the first port of call. If you talk, thinking about clinical operations, basically try and speak to us. You know, that's what we'd like to get to. So we'd like, you know, our name to be kind of spread
global.
Out.
Get it out there.
Yeah, exactly. But it is a case of, you know, it may be that we grow. You know, we bring on more people down the line as we need to. It may be that some companies want certain other services that we haven't thought about yet that we actually have to consider. You know, at the moment, we're very much around putting solid foundations in place, and then, you know, helping them be their kind of de facto ClinOps kind of consultants as such, and rep. But yeah, I think it's ClinOps is such a multifaceted area that who knows where we may end up, you know, as far as what other services we could bring under the blue-green umbrella. But at the moment, it's just quite nice to meet lots of new companies and hopefully help them on that journey. That's what I'm kind of looking forward to in the first 6 months to year, to be honest.
Yeah, and I'm kind of dovetailed in with that because that speaks to us, you know, again, being naturally curious. So if there are things that people would like us to do, you know, we've got a can-do attitude and, you know, we will look to find ways to make things work. And then alongside that, for me, is just continue to enjoy, you know, our day-to-day work. And I think we'll do that when we find good, excited clients that are early, you know, in the journey and replicate what we first felt when we joined GW nearly 20 years ago.
And have fun, isn't it, Steve? People forget fun is the important thing to have, you know?
Yeah, you have to laugh. You have to laugh, even when the going's hard, I think. You've got to be able to, you've got to be able to enjoy your day-to-day experience. There's no doubt about it.
Exactly.
Awesome stuff, gents. Well, look, thank you very much for joining me on the show. Look, I always wrap things up with a quick fire questions round. So I don't know whether you're prepared for this or not. I don't know if I've given you any heads up about it, but I'll ask you to try and keep answers short for time purposes. But a couple of quick questions, and I'll maybe let you field an answer each. So look, if you were to give one piece of advice to your younger selves, what would it be? Steve, we'll start with you.
I have a pre-prepared one for this, not because I knew you were going to ask that question, but it speaks again something that's a little bit kind of a cheesy thing. One of the compounds that we worked with at GW was Epidiolex. That's the trade name. The generic name is cannabidiol CBD. And Matt has private number plates on his cars. One car has M77THC and one has M77CBD. And I quite like them. So one time a number of years ago, I live in a postcode M20. I've got M20CBD on my car. And people ask me, what does the CBD stand for? Again, it's a three-letter acronym, James. And so depending on who I'm speaking to, I'll say, well, it's to do with work. I'm involved in cannabis and cannabidiol is, you know, a wonderful therapeutic agent. Or I say it's Charlotte, Beck and Dad, which my family of three, my wife and my daughter. Or I say it's curiosity, balance and doubt. And so those, I think, are three really key characteristics. There's a really fascinating interview, I forget, with a CEO from a number of years ago saying what's her strongest trait that's got her to where she was. And she said it's curiosity. I think, and by curiosity, it kind of ties in a bit with doubt as well. Never be afraid to say, I'm not sure I understand that. Can you please explain it to me again? Don't be afraid to just sit down and research and explore and come up with novel solutions. So there's a curiosity. Balance, I think, again, we're in a society that can be quite polarized sometimes, and often things aren't a binary choice of zeros or ones. Often what we need to do is on a sliding scale, and looking to find that balance often for us is the best way forward that brings together the attitudes and opinions of multiple groups. And then lastly, doubt, which is absolutely make decisions, but always be prepared to listen. Got two ears and one mouth, and be prepared to say, you know what, I made that decision yesterday, but now I've listened to this, I'm doubting that that's right. And be prepared when the timing is right to be able to correct yourself. And I think that's quite a nice mantra that speaks to CBD for me.
Well, Steve, it's going to be quick fire, but thanks. Yeah, good night, everyone. No, for me, honestly, I think it's, what would I say to myself? It's actually, don't worry. Take the opportunities that come your way and don't worry. Things will work out, you know? I think we spend a lot of time thinking too much about should I, shouldn't I? Sometimes just take that leap of faith and it will work out, you know? That's my thing. There's a quick fire answer there.
That is very quick fire. And I guess, look, my next quick fire one, Steve, I hope you're not out of options for this one. It's about the number one book or resource that you'd recommend, because you've been a source of them on this podcast. I think we're going to have to the reference section is going to be huge.
Yeah, quick fire.
I love my books. I'll restate those three modern authors, Simon Sinek, Brené Brown, Adam Grant, any of those three. But if I was being honest, two golden oldies are The Five Dysfunctions of the Team by Patrick Lencioni. You can read it in a couple of hours. It's like Who Moved My Cheese. It's really short. Talks about teamwork. But the top one is Stephen Covey, Seven Habits.
I like that one.
it's really old now, but, you know, he was a Harvard professor, and those seven things as an individual, and they speak to teamwork as well, I think, are just great. If you're not sure what to do, have a look at them, and often it can point you in the right direction. Win-win every time.
I like that one indeed.
I have a couple of different ones, actually. I like Black Box Thinking by Matthew Saeed. So it basically is about learning from your mistakes. It's all about, you know, like, it's called Black Box because of what's in a plane, and that you learn from those mistakes.
Reviewing what you've done.
Yeah, and failure, don't worry about failure. Failure is a natural thing to learn from, you know? And that's where a lot of companies, I think, get too het up and blame culture and things like this, because, well, I'm just saying, well, hey, that's the way you have to naturally do things to come out with a success, then accept it, embrace failure, you know? It's like WD-40, isn't it? WD-40 is the 40th iteration of their product. Water display.
I did not know that. Oh, a little...
There you go.
A little bit of knowledge.
But, you know, so it's the same thing. They had 39 things that didn't work, but that's the way it goes. So that's a really good book because it just talks about embrace failure. It's important.
I like it.
And the other one is a completely kind of different one, but is Die With Zero by remembering that you have one life and enjoy it. So they're good books.
Well, I think that's a good way to end the show, gents. As I say, again, thanks very much for jumping on. I guess for anyone that wants to reach out or learn more, what's the website? What's the best way to look you guys up?
Well, it's bluegreenclinical.co.uk or find us on LinkedIn, Blue Green Clinical. Happy to jump on calls with anyone and go from there.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much, gents, for being a part of the Huxley Morton podcast. I will certainly keep in touch.
Thanks very much, James.
Cheers, James. Thanks so much.